compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. I hope you enjoyed your 21-hour break. I did. The number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. You can call that number now. We'll get you on the air with your question. 888-914-9149. I want to share with you this story in the Wall Street Journal. Headline, Supreme Court to review Mississippi law limiting abortion rights. The Supreme Court said it would consider the legality of a Mississippi abortion law that seeks to ban the procedure, aka abortion, after 15 weeks of pregnancy, a case that gives the justices an opportunity to revisit precedents protecting abortion rights. By the way, I want to go on record once again for the umpteenth time. No one has a right to an abortion. And I know, in the law it says that a woman has a right to abortion, but that's not my point. There have been bad laws, bad decisions from the Supreme Court, for example. There was a time when the Supreme Court in the 19th century upheld slavery with bad decisions. So let's not kid ourselves into thinking that, well, the Supreme Court said that it's constitutional. Yeah, the Supreme Court has been wrong before. It's wrong about this one. Not this Supreme Court. I'm talking about the court in 1973. But my asterisk that I want to insert into this article is this. Nobody has a right to take the life of an innocent person. And because life begins at conception, that little blob of tissue or clump of cells or fetus or whatever term somebody might want to use, that is an innocent human life. That's when human life begins. Scientifically demonstrable. There's no question about it. That's when human life begins. Oh, and by the way, the clump of cells argument, when you run into that from somebody, well, that's just a clump of cells or that's just a mass of tissue. First of all, remember that that is what a human being looks like at that stage of development. That's what you looked like at that stage of development. Just like you look the way you look now, at however old you are now, which is how you look at that stage of development that you're at now, that's how we all looked when we were at that stage of development. And it seems sort of like self-evidently obvious. Sometimes, though, you need to put that into a conversation. The second thing is that you don't become human at some point along the way. As soon as human life begins, that life is human by definition. So rather than getting lost in those polemics, I just want to tell you that whenever I read to you or mention something that I'm quoting that says abortion rights, I would put it in the same category as like slavery rights, slave owner rights. No one has a right to own anybody else as a slave. So if you were to read literature from long ago that referred to the rights of slave owners, you can just dismiss that as nonsensical because on the face of it, nobody has the right to own slaves. You don't have the right to own anybody. No one has the right to own you, et cetera, et cetera. I think you get my point. So back to the article. The court's one-sentence order on Monday, coming after 8 months of deliberation, crystallized hopes and fears of partisans who have battled for decades over the abortion issue and the direction of the high court. Republicans have long sought to build a Supreme Court with enough conservative justices to narrow, if not abandon, precedents dating back to the landmark 1973 decision in Roe v. Wade that established a woman's constitutional right to choose abortion before fetal viability. Pause. And that would be in the same category as when the Supreme Court in the 19th century established a slave owner's rights, constitutional right, to choose slavery, etc. You can see where you need to draw the red line. Democrats have made the preservation of so-called abortion rights a central plank of their opposition to dozens of Republican nominees, to the federal judiciary. See, it is true that this is a highly politicized topic. It's unfortunate because it's a moral issue more than a political issue, but it has become a political issue, for better or for worse. The fact that the justices decided to take the case indicates a willingness of at least five of them to revisit existing precedents, says University of Chicago law professor Jeffrey Stone, who has written extensively about the history of the Supreme Court's abortion rulings. The only reason to hear the case would be to do that. Okay. The court will consider the case during its next term, which begins in October. If Mississippi wins, the Supreme Court would be allowing states more room to regulate abortion than at any time since Roe. The court wouldn't have to explicitly overturn Roe and other precedents, but any ruling for the state would put significant limits on abortion. Mississippi's only abortion clinic, the Jackson Women's Health Organization, challenged the state's 2018 law as unconstitutional. Two lower courts agreed, saying an unbroken line of Supreme Court rulings dating back to Roe established that states can regulate but not outright ban the procedure in the pre-viability months of pregnancy. If you ask me, what they should do is just regulate the heck out of it so that it becomes effectively eliminated, you know, effectively banned. Not technically, but for all intents and purposes, banned. That's the way I would try to approach it. Mississippi's law would allow abortions after 15 weeks only in cases of medical emergencies or severe fetal abnormality. Yeah, the baby's got an abnormality, so let's kill it. I mean, I don't even like those exceptions, because here again, you're taking the life of an innocent person. If you ran across an innocent person, you know, in let's say a newborn baby with some fetal deformity, how would you feel if you heard somebody say, yeah, let's kill it? Yeah, you know, is it really worth it? I mean, what kind of life is that child going to have? Yeah, let's just kill it. We would rightly be horrified. Well, that's effectively what this allows for. Yes, it's progress. I agree. It's progress, but it's not enough if you ask me. Let's see. The state argues that fetal viability, defined by the Roe versus Wade court as the capability of meaningful life outside the mother's womb, shouldn't be the standard for allowing states to ban abortion, saying lawmakers had legitimate interests in protecting fetal life from the outset. By 15 weeks, the human fetus has made important physiological developments, and abortions are riskier to the mother, the state says. In a tweet, Republican Mississippi Attorney General Lynn Fitch, who filed the appeal, said the state law aimed, quote, to promote women's health and preserve the dignity and sanctity of life. I remain committed to advocating for women and defending Mississippi's legal right to protect the unborn. The Supreme Court's decision to consider the Mississippi ban is, quote, this is from a NARAL representative. NARAL, Pro-Choice America is the name of the group. That person says this is an ominous sign and an alarming reminder that the threat to the legal right to abortion is imminent and real. You bet it is. And I hope it remains imminent and real for as long as it takes to overturn this stupid Supreme Court decision. So the NARAL person says, if Roe versus Wade were to fall as a result of this case, states across the country are poised to ban abortion. Yeah, exactly. The impact, he says, would be devastating. Can you imagine the devastating impact this would have on big abortion's financial inflow of money? That would have a devastating impact. Blah, 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 blah.
They're not going to like that.
Oh, like because I'm saying it?
All of it.
Like they already kind of like me, but now they won't?
Yep.
Uh-oh. Over at Big Abortion?
Uh-oh. You going to lose sleep?
No. No, I'm going to be here to say this forever. For as long as God gives me breath in my body, I'm going to speak out as best I can for as long as I can. Don't
Amen.
You know?
Amen.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you, Cyrus. But you know what? This goes on and on and on and on. It's a worthwhile article. I don't mean to impugn the article itself, but it's worth reading to understand where we're at. And Cyrus, for me, there's not a bigger issue, because that is about as big as it gets, but there's another big issue that I see in this story, and that is we will finally find out.
Yes.
If these, you know, ostensibly pro-life nominees and now Supreme Court justices, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Gorsuch, Chief Justice Roberts, for whom I have very little confidence in matters such as this, and also our newest justice, Amy Coney Barrett, and they were promoted and appeared to be, for all intents and purposes, pro-life and willing to defend unborn life among other forms of life, and if given the chance, I'm still holding out hope, it seems that they would be willing to overturn that horrendous and stupid decision, Roe versus Wade. And now we get to find out. Now we'll find out if they really are the pro-life justices that we were told that they were and that we hope that they are. That's interesting too, don't you think, Cyrus?
I definitely think so. This is a time for hope and prayer, and it's exciting to see this come about, and it's also a bit scary knowing how some of this has gone in the past when I think it's going a certain direction. You know, you look at the numbers, and it's like, oh, well, this is a shoe-in, and then it doesn't happen. So I'm no longer overly confident in the system.
Yeah, if ever I were that confident.
Yeah, in the first place, right.
You know what else, though? I have a feeling deep inside, oh, yeah. I have a feeling that the race to pack the Supreme Court with 4, 5, 6 additional and liberal Supreme Court justices will go into overdrive. I really think that's what's going to happen alongside this.
That would be interesting. I didn't even think about that. And if this does come to pass and we win that race, then there will be nothing to stop them from packing.
Oh, gosh, yes.
So this might be it. This might be the chance.
You're right about that. Because I don't know how quickly the people on the other side could get the Supreme Court packed with liberal justices to offset this. I mean, it might be a horse race. Might depend upon who can get there faster. Hearing this case has been set for October of this coming fall, so it's hard to know whether or not they could pack the court that fast. I don't know. It remains to be seen, but I bet you that they're going to try to do that as quickly as possible. So anyway, so that's going on. But, you know, on the positive side, there's always a little bit of positive, no matter where you look. In this case, we can look to Malta. Malta, that little island country in the Mediterranean, its president, George Vella, and this is an article here from Life News, the president of that little country, George Vella, has made it clear that he supports the rights of unborn babies. It kind of makes you want to, I don't know, maybe either ask that guy to run for president or maybe spend a lot of time in Malta, maybe. In an interview, he talked about a bill introduced earlier this month to legalize abortions in the country of Malta, which is one of the few countries in Europe that still protects unborn babies by banning abortions. He's a medical doctor and now the president. He told a news outlet that he never would sign a bill allowing the authorized murder of unborn babies. And the words authorized murder, those are his words. You either kill or you don't. There are no ifs and buts, he said.
That's
he also reiterated.
Refreshing to hear a leader talk so plainly.
Yeah. You either kill or you don't kill.
Yep, I like that.
Yeah, I like the no killing part.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
That's my favorite part of what he just said. So he says, you either kill or you don't. There are no ifs and buts. He also reiterated a promise he made in 2019. Are you looking up Malta, like the weather in Malta, so that maybe you can spend
can
some time
there? Can I
produce
the show from there?
I bet it could happen.
Sounds nice.
I don't think I want you that far away, though. Anyway, so he reiterated a promise he made in 2019 to resign rather than sign such a bill. Can you imagine a president of the United States saying, I will resign from the presidency if the Supreme Court allows abortion? I mean, that's, and then to actually do it. I will never sign a bill that involves the authorization of murder, he said. I cannot stop the executive from deciding. That is up to Parliament, but I do have the liberty, if I don't agree with a bill, to resign and go home. I have no problem doing this. According to a news outlet in Malta, a 2020 survey found overwhelming public opposition, to abortion, and just 5.2% of the Maltese residents said they support unrestricted access to abortion in the first trimester. The pro-abortion bill has little chance of passing Parliament after both Nationalist and Labour Party leaders said they oppose it. I love this. I saw that yesterday, and I thought, you know, there is a little bright spot. I wish that maybe the people here in the United States would take a look at that. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, I don't have my screen for the calls is not up.
Oh.
Do we have anybody waiting?
Yeah, let's go with Mary in the Chicago suburbs. Hello, Mary.
Good morning, Mary.
So as we head into the month of June, also known in the secular world as Pride Month, My corporation is fully embracing this aspect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everything from the rainbow logo to putting things in our signature line, using presentation backgrounds.
Okay.
And so I'm torn as to, as a good Christian Catholic, what am I called to do and not do?
What is your company asking you personally to do? I mean, are they saying we want you to do X, Y, or Z specifically?
Well, I'm anticipating this to happen because I'm also happen to be in HR, who's fully, obviously, pushing this initiative. So I'm trying to do that in balance, which I know it won't matter, but the fact that obviously I respect and love and work with all people, you know, to me that doesn't matter, but that of course isn't the line that most corporations are expecting these days. So any advice on, I was hoping to kind of fly under the radar, but I'm anticipating that it might not be the case. So I'm just looking for advice on how to handle it, how to respectfully maybe present my case.
Okay. I very much empathize with you and I sympathize with you. I can't say that I've ever personally been put in that situation, but I can try to imagine. This actually makes me repeat my question. It will depend, my answer, I guess, would depend upon what it is they're asking you to do. If they're asking you to just sort of passively work there while all around you this kind of thing is happening, then my advice would be just do your job well and keep your head down. If they're asking you to compromise your morals by participating in some material way to promote this, then obviously that creates a quandary for you. And, you know, the nuclear option would be to find a different job. And some people I've met personally who have shared with me their own, you know, trials in this area have done exactly that. And it's difficult and it, you know, it can be a real cross to carry. But so let's just go to the nuclear option first as kind of like the worst case scenario. Let's say this is the worst case scenario. And they're saying to you, Mary, we want you to lead a class for this department and explain to them how important pride is and all the things that if it contains something that you realize you would be promoting, even though you don't believe it, but you'd be promoting it, then to my mind, that would present a crossroads. And then at that point, you'd have to decide, do I go along to get along, which I would not recommend, or do I look for a different job? Now, there may be some ways that you could avoid getting fired. I mean, if you frame it in such a way that they legally can't do that to you, I don't know how that would work. You know, maybe you and HR would probably have more insight into how that would go down. But that's one possibility. Do it in such a way that they can't nail you for something that's on the books. But the other possibility would be to just say, I'm sorry, I don't believe in that. I don't want to participate in that. And maybe they will give you a pass. They might say, okay, we'll give it to somebody else. Do you think that would happen?
Yeah, I'm not so much afraid of out and out firing, more just kind of going forward. I think everyone will quote unquote know I'm a bigot. I don't believe that I am, but that would be the interpretation. And as of right now, they're not requesting that I do anything as you suggested. More like I say, putting something in my email signature line about company name Pride, using logos, that sort of thing. So that's and we haven't gotten full instruction yet. I'm anticipating that in a couple of weeks. So I'm just trying to be prepared. Like I said, I work in HR, so we are very much embracing, obviously, and implementing this process. So.
Oh, yeah. I can only imagine. And gosh, my hat is off to you, Mary, because there are a lot of people, quite frankly, who would just go along to get along. They would just, well, you know, when push comes to shove, my principles, they go out the door. So I admire you for even just planning on how you will take your stand. And
I'm worried about my soul, so I've got to be that
absolutely.
First.
Absolutely. Well, you know, there's a classic line, Mary, from A Man for All Seasons, where he's talking to, I forget whether it was William Roper, whoever the character was, who, I think it was him, who basically sold out and caved in and violated his Catholic faith and his conscience in favor of King Henry VIII. And in doing so, his prize was that he became the governor of Wales. And St. Thomas More says to him, but for Wales? Like, I mean, if you're going to sell your soul to the devil, why not at least ask for a higher price? No offense to Welsh people, but why not ask for a better bargain? He said, and you just bargained it all away for Wales? Like, come on. So stand your ground would be my advice, yeah. Mary.
I will, and I thank you. And I think just real quickly, I think kind of what you said about a new position, I think it's going to be, as the years go by, it's going to be very hard to work in the corporate world going forward, unless you're up for the big battle. You know, and I don't know that God is calling me to that, but I, you know, when I think about what my next options are, I'll have to be very careful, because even if I were to go to another organization, if it were a corporation, I would probably face similar challenges, or many would face similar challenges. So
that's right.
Oh, something more to pray about. So,
well, anyway, this song is going out to you, Mary. This song is custom made for you. Thank you. Call me back when it's all said and done, please, and let me know how it happens. We'll be praying for you. I'll be right back.
We've been waiting for a long time.
Compelling insights.
Yes, we've been waiting for a long, long time.
Unpredictable conversations.
We've been waiting for a long time.
Encouragement for your day.
We ain't gonna wait no more. We're getting ready to rock and roll.
It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
It's such a great song. And I have a feeling it's how a lot of our listeners feel when they're waiting on the phone lines and they want to get on the air. So let's get Mike sorted out, and we'll come back to Mike. We'll go now to Portland, Maine, and speak to Susan. Hi, Susan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question about things. I have a question about whether my marriage needs to be convalidated by the church. Okay. I kind of had an odd situation. My husband and I were both baptized in the Catholic Church as infants, but were not raised Catholic.
Okay.
When we met, we were attending different Protestant churches, and we were married in a venue, not a church, by a Protestant minister.
Okay.
After about 5 years of marriage, we entered the church at the Easter Vigil of that year. Mm-hmm. And talking to a friend recently, she mentioned having her marriage convalidated, and I didn't even realize that, you know, ours may not be valid. And my concern is that we've been serving pretty publicly in a lot of volunteer capacities in our parish, and I don't know if we need to step down until that happens.
Okay. Well, thankfully, this is an issue that can be resolved easily and relatively quickly. What I would suggest is that you make an appointment with your pastor and explain to him this new information that's come to your attention, and then ask him what steps would be necessary to convalidate your marriage. That can be done, and it's not an ordeal. I want to front-end load my answer for you. Just real quick, Susan, I want to front-end load my answer by recommending a book for you. It's called Annulments in the Catholic Church, Straight Answers to Tough Questions. You're not dealing with an annulment. I understand that. But there are issues that you're dealing with that are covered in this book. It's written by a canon lawyer. His name is Ed Peters. So if you want something that can give you much more detail, that would be the book I'd suggest.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did ask my priest. I live in an area with very few Catholics, very few priests, and he wasn't sure on the answer, and I knew it would be a while before I heard back, and I just wanted to make sure I was doing the right thing in the meantime.
Yeah. How far are you from the city of Portland? I mean, I'm not trying to get your exact location, but are you within driving distance where you could go and visit the chancery office for the diocese?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Well, surely there will be personnel on hand there in the marriage tribunal who could give you, you know, really exact information. And there's really not that much to it, honestly. One of the questions that comes up in my mind would be, I'm presuming that you and your husband have not received your other sacraments of initiation, like confirmation, for example. Have you received
that
sacrament? Oh, have you? Okay.
Yeah, we have. We fully became part of the church. Yeah.
Well, that decomplicates everything. Yeah, this is a very easy thing to have taken care of. And so you should have no difficulty, and it should happen very quickly.
Okay. And I know you may not know, you know, for certain, but is it, do you think it's licit that we are serving in the parish and that we're living as a married couple? Or I'm just trying to, as I said, I'm trying to make sure I'm doing the right thing here.
No, that's good. I admire that. Well, this is the question that I'm thinking that you could get a very quick answer to. And I mean, if you're uncertain and you want to make sure that you're doing everything right until you have a chance to get the information from the priest and get the word get your marriage convalidated, you could choose to live as brother and sister, and that would be meritorious, I think, especially since you're seeking to do the right thing. And so given that question mark, doing that would further demonstrate your commitment to doing what's right. But yeah, so the convalidation is very simple. It's just, you just renew your wedding promises and you do it in the presence of the priest, typically. Could be a bishop or a deacon. And your marriage is convalidated. It becomes sacramental.
Right.
And it would be, I mean, you could do it today if there were a priest available to do it for you.
Right, which, yeah, the unfortunate thing is that we often don't even have priests for reconciliation. So.
Oh, that's tough. That's a tough situation. Well, in that case, then, I would fall back on my earlier point, and that would be, you know, make the drive down to the diocese, to the offices. Maybe call ahead, see if you can make an appointment, and ask if your marriage can be validated even then and there. It can be done. You just have to renew your marriage vows in the presence of the witness, the priest, and it's done.
Okay. This is all
right, Susan.
Helpful. Very helpful information. Thank you.
I thank you. And I admire you for seeking to do the right thing. What did Jesus say? He said, seek first the kingdom of God, and everything else will be added unto you. And that's the approach you're taking, so I admire that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Great to talk to you. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Paul, listening in Long Beach, California. City by the Sea.
Hey,
hi,
Patrick.
Paul.
How you doing?
I am well, thank you.
Yeah, just quick, I want to give a word, a little support for the woman who called about pressure from her company.
Mm-hmm.
It's not unusual. Sometimes they put you in a position where you're questioning, you know, the ethical part of it. So it's not always about gay. It could be about anything. So word of support for her. And I would just suggest to her that she preface her protest to her company, put it right out there. I'm uncomfortable because of religious grounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then she would have a little umbrella protection, and she put it right out there in front of
her. Yeah, that's what I was getting at when I agree with you. I was getting at the same thing when I said to her, frame it in such a way that it makes it difficult for them to come after you. You know, frame it in terminology and appeal to certain things that they would have a much more difficult time trying to get rid of you. You're saying what I said in a different way, but I agree with you.
Okay. Well, just a word of support for her, and thank you, Patrick.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever been in that situation yourself, Paul?
Yes. Listening at an academy to some guy rant about Chomsky and these other guys, you know, basically atheists.
Mm.
Of course, I was able to speak up a little bit about my...
Was that a military academy?
And... Yeah, there could be, you know, other things, you know, that, mm-hmm. you know, there might be ceremonies or something now that it's a multicultural. Not that they're aggressive at making you, but, you know, things you might want to excuse yourself from, like some ceremony, a non-Christian ceremony or something for a opening day or something. But basically, more and more now, the position this lady's in is those particular gay rights or something. More intense. She might even think about offering to put the Catholic perspective, the very generous Catholic perspective, on how we treat gays. That it's just qualified, if I'm quoting it correctly, it's basically in the end just qualified with celibacy. She may want to put it out there that, okay, you know, if you want me to talk, then give my opinion, what the church's opinion is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll bet they'll say, no, we don't want that. Anyway, well, Paul, I'm with you, and I agree with you. Thank you for speaking up and offering a word of support for her. I'm sure she appreciates it, too. Thank you. We'll get back to Mike now in Milroy, Minnesota. Hi, Mike. Let's try it again. Welcome.
Hi, Patrick. My question today is, the Apostle John called himself the disciple that Jesus loved in the Bible. And that sounds like he's, I don't know, like, I'm the one he loved, not you guys, or he sounds like he's putting himself above other people. Could you speak about that, please?
Well, all I can say is that he uses that phrase. He doesn't refer to himself by name. And actually, none of the four gospel writers do. The books are anonymous, those four books. So why did he say that? I think it's most likely because the people who knew the apostles and who knew Jesus would immediately know who he was referring to, because they would have known about this special closeness that he had with the Lord. Was he putting down anyone else? I don't think so. I mean, he was a virtuous man. He spent 3 years with Jesus learning humility, and he was an apostle after all. So I don't read into that any sort of boastfulness, but rather, instead of using his name, hey, I'm John, I'm the apostle, you know, with Jesus, he seems to be, like the other writers, humble, and just using that to describe his friendship, and that would be a tip-off to people to know who he was. That's what I see in it. I don't see anything negative.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. I hope that's helpful, Mike. Let's see. Let's go to Ed now, listening in Raleigh. Good morning, Ed.
Hey, good morning. Hey, a little tongue-in-cheek, but also serious. You know, as a convert, you know, I try to go back as far as possible to make sure I know what the early founders were doing. Of course, I go back to the 1960s when Vatican II started. And if we go with the New American Revised edition, I'm just curious why. I'm thinking we should change the Hail Mary, because the Hail Mary that I learned, I was trying to figure out why it wasn't in the New American Revised edition. And lo and behold, I had to actually go back to the Council of Trent, the Douay Rheims, to see that the Hail Mary that we say actually comes out of the translation from the Latin Vulgate.
That's right.
So, Patrick, you have quite a quite a nice audience there. Do you think we should make a push to change the Hail Mary to come directly from the Revised edition instead of what everybody else is currently saying, because that's part of Vatican II?
Is this the tongue-in-cheek part of your question?
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Because, so, you know, you can guess what my answer is, right?
Seriously, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I would not support amending the Hail Mary to fit a modern English translation. I think the way we were taught to say it as children is exactly how it should be said, because it's a literal translation of the Latin Vulgate from St. Jerome, which was a literal translation of the original Greek. So that's my take.
Right. So, yeah, exactly. So, you know, I've tried to make it a point here. I've been reading the Douay Rheims Bible. And at the same time, I've been simultaneously reading the Revised edition, and, you know, just reading John 6, where he says, this is real meat, versus what's in the Revised edition doesn't use the term meat. So mm-hmm. I agree with you that we can't change because in the apocalypse, in the last book, it says we can't change, alter, and all those other things. So if we can't change that,
well,
and it's not in Luke 1, then mm-hmm. how do we know that the other translations within the revised edition, why can't we think it the same way? I mean, I know these arguments have been out a long time.
Yeah.
But it's just making so much sense that we should not be using the revised edition.
Fair enough. I mean, I don't have a copy. I never use that edition of the Bible. I don't really care about it one way or the other. It doesn't, you know, it's not part of my world. As far as I right. know, that's also not the edition that is being used and in the lectionary. I think it's the earlier version of the New American Bible. I'd have to check on that to make sure I'm correct, but I think I am. So for my money, Ed, I would just ignore it. I mean, I would not bother with it,
yeah,
and then you don't have to worry about it.
And I am, but you know, in our church we have the New American Revised Edition, and that's what, you know, a lot of folks are using. But when push comes to shove, the prayers that we say and that we love so much as Catholics, we're not even using that Bible. We're using the Douay Rheims translation from the Council of Trent.
That's fine. That's fine.
I don't have that freedom. I'm just thinking aloud with you here.
Yeah, no, yeah. I get it. Life is too short and time is too precious for getting, you know, hung up on things that don't really matter. And as far as like your prayer life is concerned and study and spiritual sure. reading, I would use the Bible translation that helps you the most. And if that's the Douay Rheims, awesome. You know, I've got a copy and I consult it. It's not the one I use for my devotional reading, but I do use it and I appreciate it for what it is. So that's my take on it. And don't, you know, maybe this sounds condescending. I don't mean it to sound condescending, but don't waste time with a translation that's just going to irritate you.
No, I understand. But, you know, as a convert and everything, I'm trying to just really look at everything, you know, to include the Angelus. I mean, the Angelus comes out of the Douay Rheims, not the Revised Edition, which is a beautiful prayer as well. So, but I appreciate your comments, and I agree.
Right on, Ed. Happy Taco Tuesday. I appreciate the call. Thank you. 888-914-9149. There's Cyrus on cue. Say it, Cyrus. Say it. Nah, he's not going to say it. There you go. Good job, Cyrus. I'll be right back. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
At the intersection of faith and culture, The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. This is The Patrick Madrid Show, and it is Happy Taco Tuesday, too. 888-914-9149 is the number to call to be on the air with me. 888-914-9149. Okay, I've got a special treat for you. This is a new article that just appeared this morning in First Things, written by Bishop James Wall, who is the Bishop of Gallup, New Mexico, a great friend of the network, a friend of mine, I'm happy to say, and he just wrote a piece called For the Care of Souls, and I'll read it to you. It's not terribly long, but it just came out, so you're among the very first people to hear this or read it. So Bishop Wall says, in the past few months, several Catholic bishops have issued statements on the question of whether to publicly deny pro-choice politicians the Eucharist. I am grateful to all my brother bishops who have courageously spoken out on this thorny subject. When bishops share according to their conscience and listen to others' points of view, they foster genuine dialogue, a necessary step on the path to unity. I would therefore like to respond to Bishop Robert McElroy's recent essay, "The Eucharist is Being Weaponized for Political Ends." This must not happen. That's the title of the article in question. His title, Bishop Wall says, suggests that political motives are driving the bishop's current discussion of pro-choice politicians and worthy reception. But while I don't presume to know what's in the mind and heart of my brother bishops, I am not motivated by political ends, nor are those with whom I have discussed the subject. Our concern is not political, but pastoral. It is for the salvation of souls. This issue has political ramifications, but that is not an excuse to shy away at this crucial moment. Bishop McElroy is also concerned that excluding pro-choice politicians from communion will weaken the unity of the church. Christ prayed that Christians might all be one, John 17:21, and this is an obligation we must all take seriously. Yet he also said, "Do you think that I have come to give peace on earth? No, I tell you, but rather division," Luke 12:51. Speaking the truth, Bishop Wall says, speaking the truth at times appears to create division, but often it simply exposes the division that already exists. Boy, if ever there were a money quote, that's a money quote. Let me read that to you again. Write these words down. Speaking the truth at times appears to create division, but often it simply exposes the division that already exists. If Catholics cannot agree on protecting the helpless unborn, then our unity is superficial at best and illusory at worst. Bishop McElroy then critiques what he calls a, quote, theology of unworthiness. He argues that those who would deny pro-choice politicians communion are applying a, quote, extremely expansive, end quote, litmus test that, quote, applies sanctions very selectively and inconsistently, end quote. And Bishop Wall says, is this the case? Canon law states, quote, a person who is conscious of grave sin is not to celebrate Mass or receive the body of the Lord without previous sacramental confession. That's paragraph 916, by the way, from the Code of Canon Law. As an abortion is one of the few sins that carries an automatic excommunication, which you can read about in the Code of Canon Law, paragraph 1398, there is no doubt, Bishop Wall says, that a politician who actively protects abortion and strives to make it more accessible also risks his or her salvation. It surely is not expansive to put this evil in the category of grave sin. It is fair to question whether we are cherry-picking by focusing on abortion. Why aren't we seeking Eucharistic sanctions for other evils that are rampant in society? The answer is that while there are many serious sins that diminish our worthiness to receive the Eucharist, only the gravest sins extinguish that worthiness entirely. As a body of bishops, we have read The Signs of the Times. That's Gaudium et Spes, and this is a Second Vatican Council document. And recognize that abortion is the great evil of our culture and called it out as such for decades. Back in 1998, our conference named abortion a preeminent threat. And when he says our conference, he's referring to the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. So he says back in 1998, our conference named abortion a preeminent threat. And in 2019, we reaffirmed that the, quote, the threat of abortion remains our preeminent priority because it directly attacks life itself. Pro-choice political leaders have not heeded these calls, and now we seek to apply the last remaining and most severe medicinal option we have, Eucharistic sanctions. Bishop McElroy, he says, examines the arguments for denying communion to pro-choice politicians and asks, how many Catholic political leaders of either party could pass that test? Bishop Wall says, I would suggest that this is the wrong question. Jesus was not interested in numbers, but in the salvation of souls. A better question might be, have I done absolutely everything I can as a bishop to try to bring all pro-choice Catholic politicians in my flock back into the state of grace? And that's it. Very calm, very fraternal response and worthy of people's consideration. I'll make sure that we get that posted. Well, actually, I won't make sure that we do that. Cyrus will make sure that we do that. Thank you, Cyrus. We'll get that posted for you here forthwith, and then you can read it for yourself and perhaps share it, put it on Facebook or share it with your friends and social media. Again, a very thoughtful and very, very calm way of looking at this. And boy, we can use more calm now, more than ever, don't you think? And thank you for that, Bishop James Wall. We appreciate it. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Ken, listening in Port Washington, Wisconsin. Hello, Ken.
Morning, Patrick. Yesterday, you had a lady who called in, and you gave her a little bit of Catholic apologetics because she was worshiping from time to time in other Christian churches. Could I ask you to shed more light on this? You mentioned prior to Luther that there were no Baptists or Lutherans and so forth, and that's exactly true. They were called by other names, and there were the Lollards in England, the Waldensians in northern Italy. You had the Hussites in Bohemia, and the Vatican has issued apologies for persecuting those people hundreds of years before Luther. So just shedding more light on that. Of course, there were no Lutherans. Luther hadn't been born yet, but there were other Christian groups as well as Eastern Orthodox, you know, that existed way before the Reformation. So just commenting on that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to comment.
In church history, so please, I'm done. Go ahead. Thank you.
No, happy to, Ken, and I appreciate you raising that question. It's an important one. So this, what you're saying, you yourself may not hold this, but this is a redolent of a theory that's held widely in Baptist circles especially. It's known as Baptist successionism, or The Trail of Blood is a book that popularizes this. It's a book by that title. And it essentially follows the same general argument, which is that the real Christians were seen by various names. You mentioned the Lollards and the Waldensians and the Albigensians and the Catharists and the various other groups. It is true that the Catholic Church waged an effort to extinguish the Catharist heresy, and the Dominicans were actually part of that. There was an Inquisition that was called to deal with this, and a lot of it had to do with some of the very damaging things that they believed. So you mentioned the Waldensians. So if you consider what these people actually believe, what you'll find is they bear very little, if any, resemblance to your average Lutheran, Baptist, Calvinist. And they believe things, Ken, that I'm pretty confident you would reject. So one of the common beliefs that you see in some of these groups, at least, is a kind of a Manichaean dualism, a throwback to the same heresy that St. Augustine dabbled with for a while before his conversion in the 4th century. And that entailed a belief that there was a duality in the universe and that material things were evil and spiritual things were good. And we know that's not true because everything that God created in the material universe, he himself said, it is good. This is in Genesis chapter 2. So that led to strange, aberrant teachings such as they held, and again, I'm going to refer to, say, the Catharists or the word was just in my head and I just dropped it. It'll come back to me. They believe that you could be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins. Many Protestants don't believe that. They believed that you should delay baptism until you were near death because they also believed that if you recovered from your illness after you had been baptized, that you would likely fall into some kind of serious sin, in which case then you could not be saved after that. There would be no further opportunity, say, to repent. And so that led to the practice of ritual suicide. In some cases, you would be starved to death, or they might have mercy on you and smother you with a pillow because they wouldn't want you to have to run the risk of falling into sin. I don't know of any Baptist who would go along with that. I don't know of any Baptist who would say that baptism does indeed regenerate. I mean, they reject that on the face of it. And there are many other examples. So my advice, just because being a radio show, I can't go on endlessly, but I would recommend as a tonic for the point that you're making, and actually really somewhat of a refutation of it, read a book by James McGoldrick. He's a Baptist. The book is called Baptist Successionism, and it is a thoroughgoing historical refutation of this notion that's popularized in The Trail of Blood, that all these different groups, including the ones that you just mentioned, that those were like the real Christians and they were persecuted by the Catholic Church and they had to stay underground. He completely debunks that notion, and he does it historically, and he does it as a Protestant. So I'll offer you that. Any final thoughts on that, Ken, before I have to go?
I have a secular history book that mentions about the Albigensians particularly.
That was the word that I couldn't remember. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Well, they were in southern France, and they were extinguished by a crusade. Like 200,000 of them were wiped out. But this secular history book I have from college days says the only thing we know about them is from the people who killed them and persecuted them. None of their writings exist. So who really knows what?
Well, that's not the case. Here's why, Ken, because the Dominican friars who were involved in the Inquisition, this is also known as the medieval Inquisition, they kept meticulous records, and they not only made records of the proceedings, but they also wrote in to refute the ideas that the Albigensians were promoting. And they were part of that kind of dualistic movement. I know what you're saying, Ken. What you're saying is that, you know, the history is written by the victors. But in this case, there is more than ample information historically to know exactly what they were teaching and preaching, and why the church reacted the way it did against it. Well, that's all the time I've got, Ken. I do encourage you to read that book, Baptist Successionism, by James McGoldrick. We'll get a link to that on the Twitter feed. I'll be right back.
I want to get back where the grass is green to the prettiest gal you've ever seen. I'm going to gallop, gallop, gallop to Gallup, New Mexico. Going to jump in my saddle and away I go to Gallup, New Mexico.